Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I didn't have any kind of aspirations to be heard by so many people so many times for so long. That wasn't the plan.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Recording in progress.
Got Robin it. Scott, M, welcome. This is a great pleasure because you have meant something, you know, in my life. And I always love to meet people who have had, you know, an impact musically on my life. So first of all, thank you for that.
That's very flattering.
I want to start with your background and ask you, in terms of your family, what sort of creative atmosphere were you brought up in as a child, if any?
Oh, okay. Well, my mother was a dancer, and she had a sort of professional career for a while in the, I'm just thinking of the post-war years. And my father, he was a fighter pilot. So he was a pilot. So that was the background. But my grandfather was both a pianist and an opera singer. So that's the kind of creative lineage, if you like.
Well, I think it shows something that, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of my family, there was no weight put on a sort of creative life in any sense. It was more like find something where you can earn money, not something where you could have a creative output that actually might fulfill you. Did they, you know, look at creativity as fulfillment in some way?
I think my mother did in particular. My father, I think he's kind of engaged with the creative process sort of later in his life. But I think he was preoccupied with sort of bringing bread to the table.
So how did they feel when you decided you wanted to go to art college? Was that for them a natural, well, for your mother in particular, a natural process?
Yeah, that was okay. Both of them were like that. They were supportive in that way. I was already painting, and I think they knew that really I was kind of resigned to that particular path.
When you got to art college, was your teacher a mentor? And can you remember what sort of input this teacher had upon your life?
Well, there was one tutor in particular called John Hoyland, who became quite a renowned artist in his own right, apart from being a tutor at an art college. And he wasn't that communicative, but there was something about him which kind of I connected with. And I guess, you know, he was, in a sense, a mentor, if you like.
Can you sort of define a bit more about what connected you to him?
Well, his work, for starters. I mean, I was pretty impressed with his work. His work was How should I explain that? Well, he was an abstract painter, but he used to work on very large canvases, huge fields of color, and he was just a very thoughtful character. And there's an interesting film which the BBC did on his life and his work, and it showed him actively, you know, working in the studio, and he would stand back and kind of meditate on what he was doing for hours. So he was a very thoughtful character. He wasn't very public, but sadly he's no longer with us, because I did, a few years back, I did try and contact him, but unfortunately he'd already been and gone.
Did he sort of also give you a wider perspective on the world in terms of art and, I think one of the things that, especially is when we're very young, is that we're often very enclosed in our own bubble, and then along comes someone and opens the door to a wider world. Was he that figure for you?
It was quite a restless period. This was 68. And we were kind of reacting against the system. And at one stage we had what we call a term, the sit-in, which was basically we weren't going to leave the college, and we stayed there for several days. That was quite interesting. But there, you know, were some interesting characters that I met at that time.
Yeah, I want to come to that. I mean, one thing, when I was I was 13 in 1972, and Bowie, who I know that you've known in your life, Bowie for me represented more than someone who just made music, because I was a gay teenager and felt very alien to my society. Bowie provided, in a sense, a world where I could belong.
Right.
Was there an artist or a type of music? I mean, you know, you're mentioning 68, so I sort of, my head goes to a certain type of music. But was there an artist or a type of music that also opened a world to you where you felt you could belong, and maybe you didn't feel that you belonged in your parents' world?
I'm just thinking the kind of artists that I was attracted to then were, for the most part, lyricists, Leonard Cohen and Dylan, and a string of others in that field. That was the, I was drawn to the kind of the folk movement, Joan Baez.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about Joan Baez, obviously the civil rights movement with Dylan, yeah, and so on and so forth. So this is something which was, coming to the fore, 68 definitely at that time. And so this was for you the world that you felt you were part of, something that was part of change. Is that the right description?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that was the case. Yeah. And I was drawn to the idea of being able to express oneself, whether it was in poetry or in song. So that was kind of, I was in between the two disciplines, painting and music, but I think it was a kind of natural transition between one, between the other. So I was doing both.
I mean, you mentioned that you met some interesting characters at art college, one of whom was Malcolm McLaren. And, right, Malcolm McLaren, like you, had a huge impact on popular culture. But what was your thinking at the time? Were you sort of planning, what I mean? Were you thinking, I want to change the world in terms of what you did musically, which was, bringing a whole different style of music into the 80s, and what McLaren obviously did with the Sex Pistols?
Yeah, I don't think there was ever a plan. I think it was, the general feeling was wanting to challenge convention and be an activist in that sense. And, to destroy something to create something new. That was very much the kind of chaotic sort of thinking of the time.
Is that what connected you to McLaren? Because when you say that, like to destruct something to make something new, that's, that is very McLaren, isn't it? So was that what connected you, this thinking?
Yeah, I think we were on the same page. That was it, really. And we spent a lot of time together, and he was he was both a source of inspiration and a great person to spend time with. I mean, he was fun. You know, he had a great sense of humor, and it was interesting on a, you know, on many levels.
I mean, people often talk about what they got from other people in terms of people would ask you, what did you learn from McLaren? But I'd like to know what you feel McLaren may have learned from you.
Well, I used to challenge what he had to say and what he thought, and he would do likewise. And so we were, in a sense, sort of at college sparring partners in that way. And I mean, I was already drawn to music at that stage. He didn't kind of show that much interest in that respect, but he's very much engaged with the history of art. And I think I found that quite interesting, because I didn't feel the academic side of the course that we were on was something that I was particularly drawn to. But I was more interested in creating a mess in the studio with the paint.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think later in your career, the way that your career has gone and the way that you have been involved in different styles and tried new things throughout your life shows a deep interest, I think, in the history of particularly popular culture and music culture.
Well, I don't think it would have been impossible not to have been impressed and influenced by what was going on in the mainstream of popular music when I was growing up. I was very much conscious of the songs of the time. And all of that influenced where I was going. There's no doubt about it.
I mean, one of the you know, you mentioned, well, we talked about Bowie earlier, and you played with Bowie as well when he was in his sort of folk sort of inspired.
That's right.
Era. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and what was he like? Because he was on the search for David Bowie, in a sense, wasn't he? At that period.
Well, at that time, I think that was in the, you know, quite early days. We were performing around the folk circuit, the clubs, and there was a club that was in Soho in London, which I think it was called Les Cousins, and on the bill that night, I was on the bill, he was, and Ralph McTell, and I kind of vividly remember at that time he was covering songs, and he covered a song by the Bee Gees, and I found that quite amusing. And I had songs which I was preparing for my first album. And so the evening was very pleasant, very kind of laid back, you know, typical sort of, I wouldn't say it was intellectual. I would say it was more of grassroots singer-songwriter scenario. And at the end of the evening, he said that he was starting a club in South London. It was described as an arts laboratory. This was in Beckenham, South London. And he asked me if I'd like to come down and join him. So, that on many occasions, I went to that club, and I was playing with another musician working with me. And we appeared there quite a few times. And David was there for a lot of the time. But then he started taking his small PA and touring as well. And he was just beginning to get traction on his music of that period, which was good. But yeah, he was interesting company.
I mean, I interviewed Tony Visconti once, and he was telling me about when they lived in, I think they lived in Beckenham, I think it was there.
Right.
Visconti lived in the same house, and he said that Bowie would imbue everything from everybody, and that he would, you know, he anything that was sort of in development, he would practice at home. So he would go to the fridge to get the milk and do a sort of mime on the way to the fridge. So it's like everything was incorporated into his daily life, which eventually went into his performance. Were you someone that actually also was so aware of all the people around you that you would also look for things that may influence you at that time?
Well, I think so. I think it's a kind of natural sort of way to evolve. You know, you're going to be rubbing shoulders with other peers who progress and absorb. And that's, I think we were sort of naturally doing that, all of us. And there was another artist, of course, you would know, Mark Bolan at the time. He was a pretty extraordinary character too. And he kind of got off the ground quite quickly. And he had good fortune to be having the support of John Peel. And at that time, John Peel was a very influential character in the scene. And I think he was responsible for polarizing creative talent, bringing it to the surface.
Whenever I've talked to artists who were in that era, they always talk about this, they're sort of, it's like living in a smaller community, like living in a bubble within the wider bubble. And this was this sort of creative bubble was a sort of fascinating part of that era, which is a difference to today. How do you look back and see that era in terms of being a melting pot where so many people came out of and who had so much impact on the world of music?
Well, it's interesting because at that time, of course, we didn't have, you know, we're in the sort of extraordinary era now of communications, and the community is unlimited, it's global. But I think at that time, it was really dependent, you know, we didn't have the immediate means of communicating with each other so easily. So it was like a bus ride or whatever to a club, or so it was kind of, it was a smaller circle. But it was probably a lot larger than we imagined, but one could only kind of become connected to the epicenter of that. You know, in physical terms, it wasn't easy to reach out in the same way. You know, there was the music press that would kind of, to some degree, give us some idea of what was happening elsewhere. And there was pirate radio too. But apart from that, it was quite limited to, you know, reaching out wasn't the same as it is now. It's a very different situation. So, I guess, you know, the transition is an incredible flip since, you know, we've kind of entered into this, the information age, as we call it. And so you've got to be so much, I mean, filtering now is the issue, having the ability to filter and, as it were, kind of connect with what you feel makes sense to you. I mean, because it's just, we can be so easily overexposed, and that is something to contend with now. You know, it's information overload.
I mean, you say about the connection today, and I fully appreciate that we're so interconnected. But back then, I think it was easier to just go out and get things. Like, you know, you could actually encounter someone and then, you know, be working with them. And that happened to you quite a lot, didn't it? You seem to have a real go-getting side to you where you would put yourself in a situation where you may be working with Ralph Mattel, for example, or people like that.
Yeah, I think we were motivated by curiosity more than anything. Certainly I was, and I was interested in traveling too. So, you know, I found myself in the early stages kind of busking on the streets of Europe, which was quite an education in itself.
In what way was it an education?
Well, because, you know, obviously when you travel, that's always it's always a very stimulating experience to travel anywhere. And the challenges that come with that, you can't possibly survive unless you engage with people around you. And maybe by chance or by choice, we meet people who can change the road we take.
Another way that, that the road we take can be changed is by certain decisions that we make when we're offered things. And McLaren and Vivienne Westwood wanted you to be involved in their empire building at that early stage, but you declined.
Immediately after the college episode, or I think we might still have been at college, we were actually living together in Clapham. And so then the idea was germinating in Malcolm's mind to have a store on the King's Road. And they were producing the content for the store. For the most part, the original material was back at the flat. So it was, yeah, I mean, we on a day-to-day basis for a while, I was helping, as it were, to put all this together. And it wasn't until later when I think Malcolm was thinking of making some kind of investment and asked me if I would wanted to come in and be a partner to that. But I was kind of mindful of my own aspirations in the music. So I kind of declined on that basis, that it really wasn't for me to kind of dilute my interests too much.
Yeah, did it actually help you by making that sort of decision? Because in a sense, by him asking you to be involved, it focused you on what you wanted.
Yeah, I guess that was probably so. We still kept in touch. I mean, you know, it was all the way through up until the time when, you know, he got to the stage where I think he found it quite difficult and unrewarding to continue with the Pistols. And I mean, I joined them on their last tour with Julian Temple, who was filming it. And then there was another band that came into the picture, the all-girl band, the Slits. And they wanted Malcolm to sprinkle the same kind of stardust on them, but he kind of had enough at that stage. That's when, you know, he asked me if I would be interested in producing a live performance of them in Paris. So, yeah, I mean, for me at that point, it seemed like a good idea, because I'd already started producing other acts and I had my own label. And so in the in that sense, it looked like an interesting proposition. So then I went to Paris, got involved with that, and then I started living in Paris, and then I met somebody who I lived with. And it's difficult to kind of compress all this into a few minutes. It's quite a big story. But there was this connection with Barclay Records, which was the company of Eddie Barclay, who was an eccentric impresario. And he was also, his company, that is, distributing the Pistols in France. So once again, you know, I was kind of spending time. I mean, I was crossing Malcolm's path all the time. We were always sort of kind of, we kept in touch, whatever was happening. So I've forgotten your question now.
Well, I started back with McLaren, but I think, you know, in Paris was a sort of, in France was a key point in the development of M, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was the key. So maybe you could tell me about how that came about.
I started producing for Barclay Records. I was producing some French acts and also some acts that had come from Eastern Europe. And so I was kind of frequenting studios there, and I got to know engineers. And it was about the time that I had did the production of that live recording with the Slits that occurred to me maybe I should get back on the other side again and, you know, go down the artist route rather than just producing. And I secured downtime at the studios where I was producing other acts. And that was really the beginning of, if you like, the M episode.
Was that where you recorded Moderna Man?
That's it, Modern Man, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I read that you met an Hungarian communist intellectual there called Gregor Davidov.
Oh, right, okay. Well, I was going to mention that, but I thought it was a bit obscure. But yeah, I understood that there were some issues with them seeking asylum in France. And I found them very interesting. And I started to produce some of Gregor's material. I don't think it was really going to ever enter into the idea of Eddie Barclay's mainstream of popular music, but he had a very interesting catalog, actually. Eddie Barclay, Barclay Records was, because they had a sort of an element which were loosely described as world music. So that was an interesting label for sure. We all had those kind of, if you like, those intellectual discussions of the time. I wouldn't say that we were being, you know, in any way really radical or radicalized. It was just a matter of kind of pontificating about possibilities in the creative revolution. But Gregor, I heard from him recently, actually, because he wrote an extraordinary film script at one point, which featured this character, M. It never, you know, went further than a treatment, but it was really engaging. And he was, quite a character, I have to say.
I mean, I read that he saw pop music as a vehicle for propaganda. And obviously that clearly had some form of impact on you.
Yeah, well, I was kind of impressed in the sense that what was else, you know, for me, the ultimately a commercial production, but it was open to interpretation on so many levels. I just found that quite extraordinary.
And that was something that affected the philosophy of M for you, wasn't it? That was something that really was part of that philosophy. But pop music didn't start off as the electronic track that we know, did it? It had a sort of progress or a metamorphosis, let's say, into what it was. Can you explain that as well?
Well, initially, I tried it as a kind of, it was the genre that I needed, the musical genre. And I needed to really kind of discover something fresh. Well, it started out, the first recording was a kind of rhythm and blues version. And then there was a kind of funk version, if you like, because I had been managing for some time the band Rugulator, which was heavily influenced by James Brown. So I was kind of, you know, obviously, yeah, that made an impression on me, albeit I was the manager at the time. So then I tried that version, but that still didn't seem right. And then I went to visit a friend of mine who I'd worked with previously for some time, actually, on and off, a man called John Lewis, who was a classical composer and an organist. And I knew that he had a small studio in Covent Garden. I think he was actually patronized by Pete Townsend. I think he gave him some financing or something. But John was doing, yeah, he was like in his own bubble, in a niche. He was kind of way ahead in the sense that he'd already engaged with sequencing, which was pretty rare, that technology at that time, apart from maybe Cologne Radio with Stockhausen or obviously Kraftwerk. Anyway, so I went to pay him a visit and I said, look, I've got this idea for a song and I still don't have a direction musically, but, you know, can we kick the idea around and could you perhaps come up with, you know, a possible means of translating what I'm trying to do here? So I'd give him ideas and he would then interpolate that. And we've just worked on an 8-track and with sequences and just did the basis of the track. And he was, you know, responsible for arranging the polyphony or the counterpoint in the track, which gave it that unusual kind of quality harmonically. So yeah, we recorded that on an 8-track and I took the 8-track back to Paris and hunted around for a studio that had both an 8-track and a 24-track so I could transfer it to a 24-track. Once I'd done that, I went back into the studio and then brought in live musicians to complement what was there, you know, with the electronic foundation. And that's when I found Wally Badaru, and I there were a couple of members of the band which I was managing, Rugulator. One was my brother and one was a friend. And that's how I built the track.
I mean, you mentioned Stockhausen and Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk, of course, from Düsseldorf. I live in Cologne, it's where you're seeing me now. And
you're in Cologne. For some reason, I thought you were in the States. I don't know why.
No, I'm in Cologne. And, of course, the radio that you mentioned, which was really fascinating because it was such an experimental radio station that it used to, when it first went out, it received so many complaints because people thought that the signal had been corrupted rather than they were actually playing music, which is really fascinating. Were you very aware of Stockhausen, of Can, of Kraftwerk, that music that came from this area during that era?
Oh, well, absolutely. I was into, for a long time prior to being a singer-songwriter, I was interested in avant-garde experimental music in the classical field, if you like, but not easily defined. And I was interested, again, those kind of the musical revolution that had been taking place with technology coming into play. And I mean, indeed, it was interesting that, I mean, Stockhausen was the first, he gave the first example of multi-track quadraphonic music. I mean, in his piece Kontakter, I don't know if you know that, which is extraordinary in performance, which he very cleverly engineered a way to split a piece into four channels by rotating the table with four microphones. And it was quite amazing reading about all this, but then actually hearing and seeing it in performance. I remember that in London. It was just amazing. But all those composers, whether it was Edgar Varèse or I mean, there were so many people that were sort of breaking ground, which weren't really considered serious classical composers, but they had the imagination to move the boundaries of what we considered music. I was just fascinated by these people in the sort of left field of classical music.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I was very much drawn to that as when I kind of went on my own journey of discovering what I might be able to contribute in my small way.
Well, the other thing about, you know, the you've got the video for pop music, which was directed by Brian Grant. You've got this whole concept in this song, and I think that's why it was so impactful, because it wasn't just the music, and that it was obviously, you know, on a very basic level a catchy tune. It had a depth and an impact because of this whole concept, the sort of businessman. It's almost like the MTV beginnings in a sense, and I was a presenter on MTV in Europe for many years.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very much seen as one of the most impactful videos that had been made, and because also musically, and the presentation of it in this sort of business style, in the commercialism of music. How aware were you before you released that track that you had something that would be a worldwide massive song that would last forever, in a sense? Were you aware at all?
Well, you know, one's free to dream, but I didn't really, I was just so kind of focused on what I was doing. I just wanted to put something together that, to my ear, there was no room for anything, no padding. It had to be very functional. It had to be very clear, clean, and focused musically. It's very hard to sort of kind of describe clearly what I mean by that, but I wanted it to be a departure from everything that had been typical in the mainstream popular music, but at the same time I wanted it to embrace of all of that as well, because that's what I was brought up on. So for me it was like I used to think, well, okay, 54 was the moment when rock and roll kind of hit the vinyl, and in 79 I thought it's 25 years, so maybe I could sort of, it could be like a homage, you know, to my experience, my journey through popular music at that time. So I was trying to incorporate everything in there, but doing it in not such an obvious way, but subtly just alluding to all the influences and that had kind of reached out to me in music, popular music.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
The success was enormous of this track. I mean, absolutely phenomenal. And it must have had a huge impact on your life. And many artists believe that success is going to, you know, completely change their life in a positive way. But there can be a positive aspect and there can be a negative aspect to that sort of enormous success that happens very quickly. What do you remember about that time in terms of what it gave you and what it took away?
It gave me, obviously, the opportunity to explore anything creatively. But it was, you know, the expectations, and certainly from, you know, the record label, they just wanted me to kind of get into a sort of formulaic, repetitious kind of delivery of music and yeah, basically give them the turnover that is essential to a label, as a commercial success was what they were concerned with. I just felt, been there, done that. So now I want to go look at all the other sort of areas of music that interest me. And I just chose to really, I had the freedom and I felt I had the right to kind of explore any other avenue that I was interested in. I didn't really want to be typecast or stereotyped in any particular genre. So that was good. But the downside was that the expectation was for me to repeat myself. And I just thought, well, the point that I was making, it really couldn't be made more than once.
Yeah. And also that success means different things to different people, doesn't it? I mean, I was a successful TV presenter at one stage, but very unhappy and something that I didn't really enjoy.
Right.
Ended
right.
up being a screenwriter, which is something that fulfills me and something that I feel much closer to. And it's my own creativity.
Mm.
You created something which was a, you know, enormous success. And then it's the realization that actually this isn't what I necessarily want to do or repeat, but I want to go somewhere else and follow that path of also getting new input and change. So I just wonder how you define success from today's perspective.
Success then was definitely perceived as being commercial success, you know, like kind of, you know, I don't know, footballers' wives. I don't know why that comes to mind. Now I think success is being comfortable with yourself and knowing yourself and not letting, now this is not, I'm not sounding like, I don't want to sound like a control freak, but basically what I think is the most precious thing of all is to make the decisions that you feel intuitively are meaningful for you with the precious time that you have, or that we all have. And if you can, that should be the reward in itself, to be able to do that which you love the most. And you know, the spin-off, yeah, I mean, there may well be sort of some commercial return that is useful or attractive, so that you can perhaps be in a situation where you can kind of invest those resources into others who are like-minded and work together, this kind of thing. But yeah, I think success is a strange word when you think about it. It's, you know, there can be simple things in life that can make you feel successful.
Do you
it doesn't
feel
have to be on a public scale, doesn't have to be on a worldwide scale. I had no idea really what I was letting myself in for, but I enjoyed actually putting work together, as I do now, actually. What I'm working on now, I'm enjoying it exactly the same way. I'm starting to feel comfortable with what I'm doing, that it's, you know, I'm not doing it. The point is, I'm still discovering, and that's what I was doing then, and that's what I was so absorbed in. I didn't have any kind of aspirations to be heard by so many people so many times for so long. That wasn't the plan. I wanted to share what I was doing, for sure, but it could have been, you know, 10 people. It could have been 10,000 people. It didn't really matter. As long as somebody was listening, that was good.
Do you feel that you received the credit for what you achieved back then in terms of actually defining an era? And, you know, I mean, I was listening to A Modern Man and I was thinking, wow, Duran Duran listened to that. You know what I mean? It was like, there's so many aspects of your work which you see in other people's work that came later. And in terms of the concept, the visual style, everything. And I just wonder whether you feel that you received the credit that you really deserve, because a lot of artists seem to receive that later in life rather than at the time.
Well, it's interesting that I think the moment when I felt any sense of recognition was actually when I was approached by Yuichi Sakamoto, and he had listened to Official Secrets. And then he sent me his album, B2 Unit, I think it was, Yellow Magic Orchestra. And he said, you know, I'd really like to work with you. And I said, well, actually, you know, I'm listening to your album now and it's intriguing me. So, yeah, let's do that. So it was kind of that sort of feedback at that point where I, yeah, that was hugely rewarding to have another artist to kind of engage and feel that, you know, we had something in common and we could actually collaborate. I mean, equally so when, you know, just going back to David again, you know, how he sort of kept, we kept crossing paths. And when he rang up, I was working in Montreux at Queen's Studio and said, can I come down? I said, yeah, absolutely. So it was that sense of feedback from people, I suppose, where there's a kind of mutual sort of respect. That's really nice.
Yeah, you also worked with Andy Gill, didn't you? You worked with artists that were on the cutting edge of electronic music, and I think that's really inspiring to see that you went from something that was extremely commercial to then take risks and go in a different direction again.
Well, that's interesting you say that. I mean, that's very helpful because I guess that's where I was at. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I thought more than ever I should take risks now because I can afford to, you know, why not? Why not kind of engage working with people who may be lesser known, but in my view, they have so much to offer because they are quite radical. I mean, I was always attracted to sort of radical personalities anyway, and that's probably why, you know, going back to Malcolm, that's why there was a connection there.
I mean, you mentioned earlier about what you're doing today, and do you feel that you're radical and still inspired and today in terms of what you're doing? Because it's, you know, sounds like you're doing extreme amount in the this year and next year. It's what's planned. That you are, in a sense, reaching another phase of your life where you can do what you want, but you can also bring it back into the public domain. So how do you feel about your work and how is it inspiring you today?
Oh, I feel as, I do feel very fortunate for some reason, BMG are just kind of, well, on account of there are two or three characters there, really kind of the support and encouragement. I mean, they leave me completely to my own resources or devices when it comes to what I'm actually doing. But they are being very constructive and they have a strategy. And I feel that the support is there quite genuinely to open up and, if you like, not feel in any way incapable of doing something worthwhile. And that's, I take what I'm doing right. Have you heard any of the new material at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to Break the Silence, Baby Close the Window. I mean, I know that you've been working on this new material.
Baby Close the Window goes back to 82. That's pretty old.
Oh, yeah, okay. But that's something that you found
Break
from
the Silence.
Then.
Yeah, Break the Silence is kind of, for me, is the first sort of it's a kind of seminal statement in a way, isn't it? Because, it's been a while that I've been, I sort of feel that I've kind of, I'm not back where I was, but I'm kind of going forward in the same spirit, which is perhaps a kind of fusion of everything that has gone before. But I kind of understand more clearly now. I've got the sort of the period that people have been so obsessed with in perspective. And I'm not daunted by it. I'm not overcome by it. And I feel that what I'm doing now has, it's relevant to me. And if that's where it's all got to begin, if you feel comfortable with it, then others will too.
So was there a period?
What did you make of Break the Silence? Tell me.
I love that track, actually. I thought it was brilliant. And it feels really modern, but it also has some, you know, bits of the past in it. Do you know what I mean? It's like got that connection. Obviously, because of, you know, this massive hit back then, there probably was a period where you felt that you were carrying this heavy load of the past. You know what I mean? I've experienced it myself, being a TV presenter that people recognize me 20 years or 30 years after I left, and I'm still connected to MTV. And that for me is nothing to do with me. You know what I mean? It's a long time ago. You know, I love interviewing people, but MTV is irrelevant in my life. I am a screenwriter essentially, and I see myself in a very different way than other people may see me, who, you know, the few people that recognize me. For you, with this, you know, this world hit, I mean, it's very different to my experience, this massive world hit, it is at one point going to be a sort of, for the audience, a defining moment in their lives, that becomes a defining moment in your life that you may not want to carry your whole life.
I'm not attached to it as other people are, but I'm really flattered by the fact that you said, you know, a lot of people, when they say, I remember exactly where I was when I heard it. And I know that feeling, because I have that with a lot of songs too. And that in itself is very flattering to have an impact on, you know, somebody's personal journey and their development. I suppose for a period it sort of felt a little bit overwhelming. But it is just extraordinary that, like, you know, here we are, was a crisis 40 years, 44 years later. And it still continues to receive so much attention, which is great. Well, I see that. Once I used to see it as a bit of a passport, but now I just see it as something which has, you know, it's there in the public consciousness as much as it is in mine. And it reminds me if one makes a truthful kind of creative gesture, it can be received and shared with a lot of people. And I guess it's interesting when coincidences start to happen, or, you know, sort of kind of, what is it? What's that? You know, you make plans and then life gets in the way. But conversely, you know, you don't make plans and life happens. It's just, and it's really interesting how, I mean, This track, which is about to be released in June, Break the Silence. I mean, it came up in, there's a lot of material which I've got which came up in the lockdown period. I developed, you know, ideas, and some of them are more progressive than others. And this was one of them. I didn't really think about it. I didn't really plan it, but it suddenly becomes so appropriate. And that's really quite interesting. And I just think that's, I'm very much in favor of chance. I just think chance is a great thing. There can be some bad accidents, but there you go. But it's really interesting this morning. I mean, you know, like somebody else who I spent had the pleasure of spending time with on several occasions was Tina Turner. And I mean, you know, Helen told me, yesterday, I was just really quite, you know, shocked. And suddenly I go back to those occasions when we spent time together. And because I almost produced some material for her, but it didn't happen. It was the time when Roger, I can't remember his second name.
Roger Davis.
Yeah, he stepped in to organize her career. And there was one song in particular, and they thought maybe, you know, Robin would do some kind of pop music on it, you know. When her album was being discussed, and as you say, producers, so forth, so on, we went into rehearsal together, and I put together a band, because what I was had in my mind, you see, was really they were looking for the kind of electro kind of production or whatever, going down that route for obvious reasons. And I was thinking a real band, you know. So I put this band together of players, and we went into a small studio and started routining material together. And then afterwards we went off and had a meal, and, you know, I loved her. I just thought, lovely person, got on with her very well. But it didn't happen. The take on that, excuse me, was that, oh, he's not doing his electronic thing. We don't want to go down the band route.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
You mentioned that BMG have a strategy in terms of working with you, which is clearly about connecting the past to the present as well. So bringing that back. And also, you know, as I said, that baby closed the window, and you said that was a previously unreleased track from, I think, 81. Right. Are you looking and at your sort of back catalogue of work that may be unreleased or things that you've recorded back then? And how is that affecting you? Because I think if you look back and you hear things from the past, it can have a sort of an impact on you personally.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's deal with this. It's very interesting, because the guy that kicked all this off, a guy called Stuart Patterson at BMG, his title is Catalog Optimization. I love that title. So, in other words, his responsibility is to come up with any means or way of possibly mining what catalog they have generate, I suppose, you know, new income for copyrights which they've invested in. And he got in contact with me one day, and he said, hello, my name's Stuart. And, you know, can you tell me, is the original 7-inch on Spotify? And I said, I'm not entirely sure. But then I looked into it, and I realized that the one which is the mix, that's what it was, because it was kind of remix. In fact, there wasn't any multi-track involved. It was a guy called Nick Launay, who was basically an assistant to Dennis Blackham, who was a cutting engineer who cut my material. And Nick, very cleverly, overnight, he took a quarter inch of the original 7-inch, and with very limited technology, turned it into a 12-inch. Which was the one which we had, you know, had a double groove, and it was, you know, known for that. Anyway, so that's the track that has been shared on so many playlists with Spotify, and I don't know, 12 or 13 million plays or something, you know, which is great. But Stuart said to me, he said, as far as I can tell, 7-inch was never uploaded to the DSPs. And I said, yeah, you could be right. So he said, well, can I look into this? I said, yeah, sure. Okay. So that was the beginning. And sure enough, so they wanted to do, you know, put that up initially. And then we got chatting, and I said, oh, by the way, I've come across something which was never released. You know, do you want to hear it? And he said, yeah, sure. So I sent over, that was Baby Closed Window. And he said they really liked it at the office, and we sent it to our office in New York, and they really like it too. You know, can we do an official release on it? Anyway, so since then, he's been educating me on the possibilities of doing this, that, or the other with, okay, the existing catalog. It all became a bit pop music obsessive. And then this was all planned for release last year. And then he came back and he said, look, we've been talking to marketing. We've been thinking, would you be interested in Record Store Day? And I said, well, what's that? I don't know anything about it. He explained it to me and said, well, if you are, we'd want to put it back now, not release it this year, last year, but release it in the spring of 23. And I said, yeah, okay. So he's orchestrated all of that. And then I say, well, look, much as I appreciate what you're doing, I'm actually sort of kind of working on current material. And would you like to hear something? So I said to him, break the silence. And he said, wow, this is great. And I said, yeah, but you're a back catalog man. No, I can sort of, I have a kind of A&R role here. Which was, you know, great news. So basically, Stuart is traveling with this all the way. So he has it in mind now to deliver a few singles and then do an album in the kind of traditional way. So now I've seriously got my work cut out for me.
So does catalog optimization also include touring?
Well, I tell you what, I mean, that would, because like, you know, we're not looking for an album, we're looking for an album early 24. And I would love to do that. And I think I might have the band to do that with. The guy that I've been working with more recently in the last album, which I put out, which was really a reflection of the kind of singer-songwriter period, Wing and a Prayer. I don't know whether you came across that one. Okay. So, which was recorded on an iPhone, actually, that particular track. But anyway, the rest of the album I prepared in Logic, working alone during the lockdown. Previous to that. But anyway, I put it together and I went to this guy who was working in a shipping container. He had a studio in Sussex. And I said, look, I've had enough of working on my own here. I need some feedback, and all the tracks are prepared and arranged, but I think it needs live players on it. And his eyes lit up because he's a multi-instrumentalist and also a very clever engineer. And so this guy is called Ali Gavan. And he has, in my view, he's been sort of I just think he is somebody that I would certainly involve in this project. He's an unconventional musician. He's a musician producer. He's got all of those things. And I haven't deliberately sort of surrounded myself with people like that. They're just popping up now. And there's somebody else that I'd like. And also, he's a producer engineer working in Brighton. And I'm going to approach him. I'm going to give him some multi-tracks to do some remixes and stuff. And he might be interested in playing live. People that I would have liked to also involve, like, you know, people like Wally Badaru, but he won't play live at all. He never did want to. So that's the end of that. But there are people out there. And certainly if I can put the right team together, yeah, I'd love to perform live. And it would be very satisfying to be performing new material. The one thing about when I was touring and chasing that video around the planet, I was doing, you know, these playback presentations on TV, miming, and I hated it. I hated it with a vengeance. I wanted to sing live, you know. So, yes, I'd really like to do that. So, and I would hope that by then, if I have a body of work, which is, you know, contemporary stuff, and of course, I'd, you know, reflect on optimizing the catalog. I'd love to put that together. I'd love to do it. But my heart has to be in it, you see. It was a fantastic experience when I did that first rewind occasion, you know, 10,000 people, and they just went potty, you know, when I performed. It was a great experience. And meeting some of those people afterwards who were just so loving and respectful, you know, just, God, it's great, you know, to have a live, you know, connection with people. So, yeah, playing live, fantastic. but I don't just want to do that song. So to answer your question, would I perform live? Yes, definitely. If I got my feet firmly back on the ground and I feel that what I'm offering now in terms of content, material, whatever, if it's getting, you know, making all the right noises, yes, I'm pretty energetic. I'm out on my bike every day. And I'm sure I could handle the aspect of traveling, but I do like things to be quite organized. I like to be able to focus myself on what needs to be done. You know, I don't want to be distracted with, what do you mean we haven't got a hotel? What's happened with the truck? I don't want all that stuff. I've been there, I've done that, did that for another band, you know. I don't want to do it for myself. So,
well, yeah, I think you've got a catalogue optimizer. So I think there will also be a hotel optimizer. I've got to go. So I'm going to say, Robin Scott M, thank you so much. I loved it when you said that you were on stage and you got the love and respect from the audience, because you have love and respect from me, and I'm sure from so many people in the world, well, from what you have achieved and your contribution to popular culture. So, Robin Scott, thank you.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.